Welcome to A Moment of Bach, special mini-series on Brandenburg Concerto No. 3. On this podcast, we take our favorite moments from the composer's vast musical output, just a minute's worth or even a few seconds, and we show you why we think they are remarkable. And this will be a three-part mini-series. The Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 is in three movements, and this week, we'll be looking at the first. We are your hosts, Christian and Alex Giebert. Today's moment comes from a cello part near the end of the first movement. Christian and I decided to do a mini-series on Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 because there's so much good stuff in here, but also because it works out great with the number 3. Three episodes, three movements to the concerto, and the instrumentation also has a lot of threes in it.
Well, three, that's a number that Bach repeatedly uses, not just here, but throughout his oeuvre. And he literally takes this number three and he organizes three main groups, let's say, cellos, violas, and violins, and divides them further into three. So three groups of three.
The voice you just heard is Shunske Sato, the artistic leader of the Netherlands Bach Society. He also played first violin on the recording that we're using for this mini-series on Brandenburg Concerto No. 3. Let's hear the very beginning of the movement and hear what he means by these groups of three. So you have three of those. Three of these little guys. And then you have three more of the little. You have three more of those. And the whole piece is constructed on these little groups of threes. Bach was really into numerology. Typically, the number three represents the Trinity. We've talked about that in previous episodes. But here, even though we have a non-sacred work, it's just an instrumental piece, not written for a church thing, but still, he liked to use groups of threes in his compositions. The instrumentation here is what's really unique. There are three violins, three violas, three cellos, and then there's one bass part played by a string bass, otherwise known as an upright bass or a double bass, and that part would have also been read by the harpsichordist. Like we talked about in previous episodes, a lot of times the harpsichordist would read off of the bass part and play the bass part and also be playing chords over that, and you can hear that in the recording here.
What's interesting here is that the cellos aren't reading off that part, but they have their own written out part, which is not always common of the Baroque era.
Yeah, and also just the fact that there are three violins, three violas, and three cellos that are all separate written out parts, that's really unusual for that day. I mean, if you had written out parts, typically the balance would not be skewed that way. There'd be more violins than viola parts. And then, like you said, Christian, the cello would typically just be reading off of that basso continuo line, but here Bach has a separate one, so there's a lot of low sounds happening in this.
Yeah, the actual bass line is marked violon and cembalo, and the violon refers to the double bass, the low viol. Just another older name for the older version of the bass, and cembalo meaning harpsichord.
The layout of the music looks really cool.
too. It's just the way that you can see these three subgroups and then the fourth one, the bass, on the page, and the way that you can see the musical material being thrown about between these three different groups. Typically, it'll be like the violins all have something similar rhythmically together. Then it'll get thrown down to the violas. Then it'll get thrown down to the cellos. This happens a lot during this piece. And then when you're watching the video, this video by the Netherlands Bach Society, it's also very pleasing to the eye. You can see it looks pretty symmetrical. You've got three violins on the left side of the shot, and then the three violas on the right side of the shot. So those are the people that are standing up, right? And then in the center, you've got three cellists sitting down. And then in the back, you've got the bass, and he's standing up, because that instrument is so big, you've got to stand. And then the harpsichordist next to him. Looking at the score again, it's beautiful to look at, especially the original by Bach. A lot of composers, we have their original manuscripts of scores, and Bach is no exception. I mean, we've talked before about how we've lost a lot of Bach's music, probably over the years, just much of it just we don't have. But we have a lot of it. We have a lot of the originals. Bach just happens to have beautiful handwriting when it comes to scores. They just look fantastic. They just look so flowing. They look like what they sound like. They look sort of elegant, and the lines move in these flowing ways. It sounds like that too. So let's talk a little bit about concerto grosso. This is a concerto grosso, which is an Italian term. A concerto grosso means that there is a group of instruments, which is the concerto, which means they have the fancy, interesting material, and then a group of secondary instruments, the rest of the orchestra, called the ripieno, which means fluff, that has the extra stuff. And the concerto is really where the cool stuff is at. But even so, like we said before, this has three violins, three violas, and three cellos, and then a bass. So then what's the cool stuff and what's the not cool stuff? Doesn't that seem all really important when the way that Bach uses it? And the answer is yes, this is kind of a loose concerto grosso in that sense. Really what Bach is doing is taking the idea of a concerto grosso, but shifting it a little and just making all these instruments important at some time during the piece. Everybody gets to be part of the concerto at some point, and everybody gets to be part of the ripieno, or the secondary material, at some point. It all just gets thrown around in this wonderful, sort of sprightly, fun way.
Yeah, this concerto, Brandenburg 3, really stretches the idea of concerto. Concerto is supposed to be this feature of an instrumentalist or a group of instrumentalists. And this is just not quite like that. This is a feature for everyone, but also their own individual sections sometimes. Sometimes they're playing background stuff, sometimes they're playing foreground stuff. And it's really a different take on how to feature an instrument or a group of instruments. Yeah.
Let's hear that introduction again. What we just heard at the end of that introduction was, after all this beautiful harmony and moving parts, we heard them all play a downward scale together, in unison. Bach really liked the music of Antonio Vivaldi. That's kind of one of the hallmarks of Vivaldi, is having the instruments all suddenly play in unison like that, especially at the end of a cadence like that. And then right after that, he's got the instrument group split again. Violins, violas, cellos. Let's hear another moment of unison instruments all together at the end of one of these phrases. You can hear how the group just really feels that together. They almost slow down on that high note and then fall down. This one thing I want to focus on with this particular performance of this piece, it's just so high quality, like we always talk about that the Netherlands Bach Society ones are.
but this is a well-rehearsed group. You can just tell. These are already professionals, but also you can tell these players have rehearsed this really carefully. They're just so synced together. There's a concept called rhythmic entrainment, and that is when you're in a room with people and you're doing something that's musical, the idea is that you feel the tempo with the other people in the room in a physiological way, not just in a mental way. And your bodies start to rhythmically pulse together. And if you have any rehearsal and you use a metronome in the rehearsal, you can achieve this effect, especially if you have everybody listening to the metronome and then playing their part. They can really start to learn how to do this. It's great to do that with, especially with younger musicians, to help their sense of entrainment. But professional musicians know how to do this. They can get in a room and they can just be part of the music together, and it can be one instrument. One thing I really like also about these videos is that the videography supports that. There's some really nice videography happening in this particular one. You can see that the videographer will focus in on the shots of just the violins when the violins have the concerto material, the interesting stuff, and then violas and cellos, etc. And then when all the instruments have those unison things together, we'll cut to a wide shot and you can see all their heads moving together right at these moments. Again, it's such precision from these players and these moments where they stretch the tempo ever so slightly. Those kind of things don't just happen. They happen through being a professional, which means rehearsing together, but also just the level of experience, the years of study that manifests through that performance. I mean, we always hear about musicians getting paid for gigs and things like that. And if anybody's going to balk at the idea of a musician getting paid a certain amount, the musician, the typical like comeback is like, well, you're not just paying me for 1 hour of work or whatever. You're paying me for thousands of hours of experience.
Yep.
I love the way that the Netherlands Bach Society group here decides to articulate some of these. Articulation just means like how you're going to hit the note. Are you going to hit it hard and short? Are you going to hit it soft and long and stretch them and string them together? These are choices that sometimes the composers make for you, but sometimes you make as a performer. And in the Baroque era, you typically don't see articulations written on the page the way you might in later eras. So you have to make those choices yourself. And if you're going to do the right thing, you really should make the choice based on a knowledge of how Baroque players would do it. So I hear them doing these articulations in this moment. Dun, 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 dun. That sounds very genuine to me. I believe that they're making an informed decision here about how to articulate, but there's also a little bit of fun, like play you can have and individuality you can have with this as an ensemble. You can make those decisions on your own and make it your own.
Yeah, we do have a few like Baroque treatises on aspects of musical performance, but a lot of it is some guesswork to do this performance practice stuff.
So coming into my moment, which comes near the end of the movement, we got to set it up here. We've gone through this kind of development section in the middle, this kind of journey. They're sitting on some of these notes and then falling down on these scales like we talked about. Then we get a couple of longer solos in the instrumental parts, like here is just violin one only. So only one out of the 10 parts having it solo. And that's a longer solo than we'd heard before. Bach continues to do this, giving the longer solos to some of the other instruments as they move along. Then here we're about to get to a restatement of the main theme. We're about halfway through it now. And we also hear a new counter melody that comes in here, new material. This thing, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, that we've heard before, and then this new thing, this bum, 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 that thing, it's new material. It goes up in a triad. It sounds a lot like the melody that we heard from Wacket Auf way back in episode 3. Then that gets passed around between the different instruments too. Then we sort of are like teetering and careening toward a little bit of madness here as we get into some of the more developmental parts of the piece here. So we're about to get to my moment, and my moment is when the cellos have the fast material and it gets really dark and kind of grungy, and but to me this is kind of like heavy metal Baroque right here. You could play this on like distorted guitars and it would sound good. You know, I can imagine like a double bass pedal happening during this part.
Yeah.
So we just heard a little bit of the moment there, and let's get to the setup of that. About 12 bars before this, we're going to get all these little solos leading down to the cello solo. You're going to have a violin solo, happens to be violin 2. Then violin 1 gets a solo. Then violin 3. Then viola 1. Viola 2. Viola 3. Now the cellos. And the cellos keep it for a while. And that bass player is just playing. Dun, 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 dun. So that's my moment. I just really love how kind of gritty that is. It feels very metal to me. Doesn't it, Christian?
Yeah, it does. It also looks hard to play, and you can tell they're going through a lot of effort to play it. I can see by looking at the score that it starts on a really low note and then it goes up to a higher note, and it would require a technique called string crossing where they would have to jump at least one string, in this case two strings, to get from one note to another one really fast. It's sort of an advanced technique. It's difficult to pull off. And these three players had to do this so perfectly in unison because they're called to play in exact unison here. There's a good distinction to be made during the Brandenburg Three between unison and harmony. Like if you have three violins playing together, that's not the whole story. Then you have to ask, are they actually playing the exact same melody at the same time? That would be called unison. But a lot of times they're playing in three-part harmony, right? And that's true in the Brandenburg Three for sure. But right here, all three cellos are playing in complete unison.
Right. And the soft violins and violas that are playing over this gritty cello line, they are actually playing in harmony, but they're so soft that it's kind of hard to hear that. But yeah, just going back to how Baroque is kind of like metal sometimes. I mean, I've heard it described as like Baroque music is more like rock and roll than classical or jazz or so many other styles. Baroque music is closer to rock and roll.
Definitely.
And it's just, it has to do with the nonstop nature sometimes where you're just shredding and shredding.
Yeah,
it has a motor. Yeah, it has a motor. It's moving.
Motor.
And it's a lot of it is kind of show-offy also. Like this really is, even though it's for at least 11 players, basically. The 3-3-3 and then the one bass and one harpsichord. So it's not a solo show-off thing, although there's plenty of those in Baroque music too. See Bach's cello suites for an example of that. But there's so much technical wizardry here. It's virtuosic. And you watch these cellists do this together, the three of them together, and it's really amazing to see that. And it's like watching an electric guitar solo, basically.
Yeah.
Then after this moment, we pretty soon get back to the recap, which means that we are recapitulating. We're coming back to the original material. And that means when you hear that, you know that the movement is going to be almost over. We're back to the original key and everything, so that means we're close to the end. And we're going to get what's called a coda, which means the end of the piece, meaning tail, right? It's the very end. one little final thing I love about the end here is just how those notes kind of float up and up and up into the higher violin parts. But then they all kind of converge, and then they all do that unison line down again until the end. Really specifically, I love this second to last measure where we have the violins going down and the violas going up in the same measure. It's hard to hear, but I'll play for you here. This is what the highest violin part sounds like. Now here's how that sounds. Now this is what the third viola part sounds like, so the lowest thing, and how the scale is going up here. Now let's hear them all played again. So that's called contrary motion. They're moving separately. What I love about this is all three violins are moving down. And they're playing in harmony here, so the notes are like spaced apart a little. They're all moving down. These chords are moving down basically together. Violas are doing the same. They have chords and they're moving up together. Which is very elegant sounding. But it's very quick. It goes by so fast. Let's hear that one more time. Now let's hear that again, but I'll let the ending play out. Right after that little bit of contrary motion, we all land on unison and we all fall down that scale together. The cellos then join, and then we all get to go down the scale together and then end up on the same note.
This is absolutely remarkable, two beats of music.
Yeah.
Or depending on how you slice it, maybe even one, you could say. Because there's the violin and viola sections, first of all, on their own, are playing in three-part harmony in parallel motion, going down or up, vice versa, right? So like you got three violins playing basically chords all the way down, which is already much less common than just two notes in harmony.
Right.
It's not illegal in this time period as long as the chords are the correct shape to do so, but it's weird that you have three notes of harmony moving down and then also three notes of harmony from the bottom moving up and
parallel.
Yeah, in parallel.
That's what's weird about it, yeah.
And then the two groups cross each other in the middle. None of this matters because it goes by so fast, and we don't hear the chaos of them crossing. It sounds nice because linearly it makes sense. We always say that, and it always comes down to that, but it's an absolutely strange and daring couple of moments, or tiny moment really, of music. And then the contrast is like maximum contrast, because the next thing is the Vivaldi ending where they just all go into unison.
Right.
So there's such a great difference between all this clustery stuff and then all of a sudden they're all together. It's just stunning.
Yeah.
And now, here's Alex's favorite moment again from Movement 1. If this introduction to a musical moment has inspired you to hear the rest of the piece, please see the link in the episode description to see the performance of the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 by the Netherlands Bach Society. Do you want to hear our new episodes as we release them? Find us on your podcast app and hit subscribe. Check out our Facebook page, Instagram page, and website at amomentofbach.com, and please rate and review us.
We also want to shout out another podcast that we think you might enjoy. It's called Faithful Forebearers. It's hosted by our friend Eric. We've talked about this once before, but it's worth bringing up again. It's a great show about heroes of the Christian faith, especially heroes of church history, and right now he's going through a series on Ethiopian church leaders, which is pretty cool and very interesting. A lot of stuff that most people in the Western church don't know anything about, so I learned a lot by listening to these recent episodes.
Yeah, and I think he's going to eventually do a music series as well, a musicians series.
Yeah, and we've said before that he's got to do J.S. Bach, and
yeah, he knows,
he totally
that
agrees.
He knows.
An important, you know, and super important in church music, and an important Lutheran also, which is something that I'm sure he'll focus on as he is a Lutheran pastor.
Right. Also, a huge, huge shout out to our artist, Sydney Lacombe. We haven't mentioned this yet, but she's the one who did the artwork for our show. We commissioned her to do that before we got started, of course, because we knew we needed a good thumbnail image. But I've worked with her before, and I've had her design something a little bit more formal for something of a cover for one of my compositions, and she did such a great job. And the way I know this is because I was a teaching assistant at UCLA, and she was in one of my classes, and I taught her music theory, her musicianship, that kind of thing. And at the end of the year, she'd bring a teeny little caricature of all the TAs, and she did this really great little caricature of me. And that's why when we were getting together to do this podcast, I thought, well, the kind of artwork we need here is exactly like that.
Yeah.
And so she did. And she hadn't even met Alex, so she had to go off pictures. But
yeah,
she got Alex just right as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's great. And Bach in there as well. And then she even snuck in a nice Easter egg about the blue and gold on my outfit, because that's our school colors from UCLA.
Nice.
Yeah. So thanks, Sydney.
Also, I like how we all have coffee cups in the picture, including Bach. And someday we'll talk about the coffee cantata.
Oh, we sure will.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty fun. And the Netherlands Bach Society has done that.
Uh-huh.
And it's great. So there is such a thing as a coffee cantata by Bach, everybody, if you didn't know that. And it's fun.
Yeah, Bach wrote something called coffee cantata. And it's a secular operatic thing. And it's gold.
Okay, well, that wraps up our episode about the first movement of Brandenburg Concerto No. 3. So, Christian, our mini-series now brings us to episode 2 for next week, second movement of Brandenburg Concerto No. 3.
Yeah. It goes like this. First chord, second chord. And that's it. So next we'll do movement 3. No, there's like plenty to talk about. And even though it is quite simply two written out chords, it's also much, much more than that. So we'll get into it.
How are we going to make a podcast episode on two chords?
Well, that's kind of what this podcast is about anyway.
I was going to say, we can do that.
This is a moment of Bach, and the moment is the whole thing. So this is like a no-brainer for us, really.
Right. Your moment is picked for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, until next time, enjoy those moments.